Oh, the plans of the young. Such daydreamers they are. Then they go off to a university or a college, and it gets beaten out of them, and they end up having to conform to the rigors of society. I don't mean to be dark. We've got a great adventure today on Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Dr. Sarah McBride has her PhD in English and Media Studies from a university far, far away. Now, I'm not going to give any spoilers. Sarah's is a grand adventure. Now, Sarah's original plan was not to go off and save the world with her PhD. She was planning to go to law school.
My goal was to get to the Supreme Court. I was like, I want to be a Supreme Court justice. Like, not Supreme Court, but like Washington State Supreme Court. I really had it in my mind that being a judge was the pathway that I was going to take, because I was really attracted to the fairness, what I perceived to be the fairness of the law. Ha ha ha. And what I perceived to be a community good that I could do and apply my sensibility toward.
This sensibility that Sarah has is about serving, well, it's about serving her community. And not just her community here in the States, it was her adopted community back in Christchurch, New Zealand. She had been in Christchurch before the big earthquakes, and she returned to help her community recover. And she was hired for a job that she really wasn't prepared for. But thanks to her boss, a longtime friend, he saw in her something she really didn't see in herself until it was time to get that PhD.
And then I sat down with David one day and I said, David, I don't know what I'm doing. And he goes, yeah, I know. And I said, I think I need to go back and do my PhD and really learn how to do this properly. And he goes, excellent. I have some funding paperwork here that I've put together for you. I was just waiting for you to ask.
Here's what I find fascinating about Sarah's journey. She is an accomplished professional in her field of work. She's been in the workplace a long time, but she needs to get better. And the only way she can get better is by getting her PhD. She recognizes it, and a relationship that she had had recognized it actually before she did and was actually prepared for the question. And this is something that I think we're seeing in 30 episodes so far of Piled High and Deep, the podcast. And I'm sure it's an ongoing ingredient to any successful PhD candidate. Three important ingredients: opportunity, relationships, and tenacity. Three important ingredients to getting your Piled High and Deep. Thanks for listening. If you like what you're hearing on my podcast, please leave a comment. If you're listening on the iTunes podcast or Stitcher or Podbean, please leave a comment. Would love to hear back from you. And if you'd like, you can send me an email at ted@themountaingeek.net. Well, enough of me. Let's start shoveling with Dr. Sarah McBride, PhD in English and Media Studies. What is it that sends somebody down a path to, on the outside, take a look at earthquakes or even more so natural disasters, but not from a scientific view, but from, and I think as I read your dissertation, from more of a sociology view?
I mean, it's a question.
Or social sciences?
It's a question I ask myself daily. Like, how did I get into this? I think I was exposed pretty early on to aspects of risk. And when I mean that, you know, when I was 2.5 years old, I was in Eastern Washington when Mount St. Helens erupted. And my hometown got an awful lot of ash coverage and ash fall, which impacted all of our lives for about a month to 6 weeks. And I remember being utterly terrified. I mean, I don't have a lot of memories from that time in my life. I was 2.5. But I do remember the fear and the concern that came with watching the sky turn black during the day. And then when I was six and a half years old, I had an unpleasant experience of watching my home burn down, my house burn down. I think That combined with living near the Hanford nuclear facility, where my father worked as a nuclear chemist early on, and then into waste management. Those early experiences of sort of being around fear and anxiety about and the lack of control over what was happening really led me to a dynamic around that happens quite frequently to lots of people. I'm not unique in this, where, you know, when you're more knowledgeable about a particular topic, you're less fearful. So for me, I used knowledge and the search for knowledge as a way to feel less fear and anxiety about these events. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And then I realized as I got older that there were aspects of the scientific endeavor that just didn't really appeal to me. Like I found people endlessly fascinating. I found, you know, in my earlier career, I really loved abnormal psychology. I took courses in abnormal psychology. I really found juvenile criminal issues really interesting. And I kind of went down these really weird pathways in my youth, in my 20s. And then certain events happened in my 20s that sort of really cemented the idea that working in disasters was something I was interested in, and it was something I felt like I could make a small contribution in. And that's kind of how this whole thing kind of happened for me, I guess.
So growing up in Eastern Washington, you mentioned the Hanford nuclear facility. That's considered, you know, a breadbasket of the United States, lots of agriculture. Did you grow up in a small town or a medium-sized town?
I grew up in a place called West Richland. So West Richland is a suburb of, or it's, I guess it's a, it's its own town. It's its own city now. It's sort of a kind of a rural-ish community. And we lived there because it was close to the reservation. We were in the 10-mile radius of the nuclear reservation. And that was so that my dad could go to work every day and it was accessible. And so I had a kind of rural upbringing. We lived on a, what we would call a lifestyle block. It was about 6 acres or so of land. And we had horses and sheep and, you know, we had a little orchard and gardens. It was a really idyllic childhood. I mean, yeah, other than the nuclear power plant and the occasional volcanic eruption and the house burning down, it was a great childhood. I had a very idyllic, calm, agricultural sort of childhood growing up there in Eastern Washington.
Yeah, I'm actually somewhat familiar with that Richland, Kennewick, Pasco area. The Columbia River flows right through there. In a previous job, in insurance, I had a client that had a big issue out there. That's all I'll say about it. But I did find myself in the area a couple of times, and really beautiful for a Colorado kid. I grew up in the mountains. It was certainly interesting and quite different. On a real personal note, I got up early in the morning and was doing my walk run. And all of a sudden I heard this weird sound behind me, and I look, and there's a paddle boat coming up the river. And it was astonishing to me, you know, something that I would have expected to see, you know, on the Mississippi River was flowing up the Columbia River. It was really beautiful. And I remember having great fish. There was great fish in the area, but I digress.
I think that Eastern Washington sometimes gets a bad rap, and I'm a proud Eastern Washingtonian. I think it's a beautiful place. Whenever I go back to Eastern Washington, and if I ever hear the coyotes, which is not that often anymore, it's so beautiful. Like when I was growing up, you could always hear the coyotes. My parents moved to Kennewick when I was about 15, which is a much more populated part of the Tri-Cities. It's I think the largest of the Tri-Cities right now. And they moved into more of a suburban type setting. And so we don't hear the coyotes anymore, but I miss that. And I miss the desert walks, you know, like at night or sunset. There's the most spectacular sunsets in Eastern Washington. And it's a really unique part of Washington State that I think a lot of people don't appreciate. But, you know, of course, when you get older and you move away and you get some distance from it, you begin to realize, well, this is actually a really interesting place where we have all these physicists and we have all these chemists and these incredibly brilliant people, as well as this, you know, agricultural community and what kind of a unique place it really is and how beautiful the desert can be.
One of those things I've always wanted to do is take the drive through the Columbia River Valley up from Portland and into that neck and into that Eastern Washington area. I've always wanted to drive a car.
Oh, the Gorge is fantastic. The Gorge is really beautiful. And what I didn't appreciate as a kid, because, you know, I didn't really learn geology as a kid that much, is that, you know, Eastern Washington is right on top of these fantastic basalt flows that arose from a volcanic fissure, you know, 25 million years ago. Or more. And sorry, I'm not a geologist, but these are really, really rare, beautiful lava flows. And the geology of Eastern Washington to me is really a fascinating place as well. And I'm really lucky that in my current job, I get to hang out with incredibly smart people who get to tell me all about it. And, you know, they get to give me all the details of the area. So they're like, oh, you're from Eastern Washington. Wow. They've got the basalt flows there. And, you know, we get to chat about it and the Palouse, which are also beautiful. And I think, the other thing I forgot to mention about, my experience growing up is there was obviously a lot of wildfires and big wildfires. And after my house burned down, we had rebuilt the house. The house didn't entirely burn down. The frame was still solid. The roof was gone, but there were things that we could repair. You know, we'd moved in, and there are kind of two interesting things about what happened when we moved in. When we moved in, my cousins live next door, and I have a cousin who is about 18 months older than me, and we were raised as sisters. And when we rebuilt the house, my mother could not get me to sleep in my bedroom in the house because I was too afraid. I was too afraid it was going to burn down again. So I would spend every night next door at my cousin's house for weeks. I'd eat dinner at my parents' house, and then I'd be like, "See ya! I'm going over to Amy's to sleep." And eventually, my aunt and uncle, who are very patient and lovely, obviously got a little tired of this. And my mom came across this beautiful Native American wall hanging that looks like an owl, and I can take a picture of it and show you. And she came home with it one day, and she said, "Sarah, this is Tokino. He's the house god. He's going to protect the house from ever burning down again." Now, mind you, my parents are LDS, and they had tried to bless the house, and they tried to get the bishop over, and they tried to say, "Sarah, it won't burn down. God will protect us." I didn't buy into any of that. My mom had a rug on a wall that she said came from, you know, that was in, you know, our Native American house god. I was like, "Yep, I totally buy it. I'm in." And I slept in the house. And yeah, that's that story of how my mom convinced me to move into the house. It wasn't, I wasn't interested in the LDS god. I was like, "Native American, I totally believe it. I'm in."
There you go.
And, by the way, my dad came down to see me a couple of months ago, and he had his little banjo case. My dad plays banjo to make him even more of a character. And he brought his old banjo case down, and he opens it up, and there was Tokino, and he put it on the wall, and he said, "Sarah, your apartment will never burn down because Tokino's here."
That's lovely. That's really
neat. It's a really sweet story. So anyway, so after my parents had finally convinced me to stay there, there was a huge wildfire from Yakima to the Tri-Cities, and my parents actually evacuated me out and the kid and my brothers, and they stayed and kind of defended the house. And but I remember looking at like this black smoke on the horizon, and you know, wildfires were kind of ever present. And it's interesting now in my career, I will work earthquakes, and I have worked earthquakes and tsunamis and volcanic eruptions and landslides. I've done all that, but I really won't work wildfire because of that experience as a child of watching your house burn down is just kind of forever marked in a way that I still can't seem to even professionally get over. So there's a little side note.
No, I it helps. As I mentioned, you know, working in the insurance industry I'm generally around during great big natural disasters. I've been in Florida for Michael, the Carolinas for Florence in the last year. I've been to Northern California for the fires. So I get that. I understand as much as I can, because, you know, while I haven't had that specifically happen to me, I have been around people who have been directly affected by the by those catastrophes, by losing everything that they've had. And so I can certainly understand where you would be coming from in terms of being hesitant to open yourself up to that situation. And it makes perfect sense. And we'll move to your research here shortly, but I want to get a sense in terms of growing up. It's, you know, your father, he was a nuclear physicist, is that, or a chemist? What was it?
So he was a chemist. So what Dad did, and I've had him explain it to me numerous times and I always forget. But basically what Dad did was ensure that the quality of the product was up to standard. So it was usable. So he was sort of quality assurance in his earlier career. And then as he got older, he worked in another part, more into waste and waste management. So how you deal with all of this nuclear waste that we have and trying to come up with solutions.
Is he a PhD as well?
He's not. He's a master's. And interestingly enough, I think he always played with the idea of getting his PhD, and he certainly, I think he had it to have it, but you know, he kind of, after his master's, I think he really felt like he had to devote his time to us kids and the family, and a PhD was just something that he couldn't do at that time in his life. So he kind of settled for the master's, which was in computer science in 1980, which he likes to joke is like getting a master's degree in handcart technology now. Like, you know, he's like, I got my master's in handcarts. Basically,
that's funny.
This is how useful this is technology wise. You know, because
it's still
like,
ones and zeros. I don't know what you're complaining about. It's still just, you know, binary stuff.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed that much.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and he knows machine language and binary. I mean, same thing, but he knows all the old languages. So I kind of think, well, don't be too hard on yourself, Dad. You did the best you can. I mean, it would have meant a lot of upheaval for him to do a PhD. We would have had to move to Washington State University in Pullman. He probably would have had to quit his job to do a PhD. And it's a five to seven year process in the United States. And he just didn't see any way that he could make that work. And I think at least a part of doing the PhD for me was like finishing that journey for my dad. Cause I know that he had wanted to do that. I know he wanted to do it. And I'm the first of the McBride family to have a PhD. And I kind of felt a little bit like I was completing that. I mean, you never do a PhD for anyone else, cause that's a terrible idea. But I certainly felt like that was something that he had wanted to do that he just couldn't do.
Was growing up, were you and your siblings, was it just kind of expected that you'd be going to college?
Yeah, absolutely. So all of my siblings have bachelor's degrees. My oldest brother has a bachelor in, I think it's environmental science and something else. I can't remember. And then Christopher, so that's Clark. And then Christopher has a master's degree in counseling psychology, and he's actually getting his PhD at the moment. I try really hard to never mention that I did it first. but sometimes it slips out. Can't help myself sometimes, but I'm really proud of him. To go back and get a PhD is hard, hard work. And he is a very hard worker. So, yeah, he's doing his on in counseling psychology as well at Oregon State University.
So everybody has kind of stayed in that Pacific Northwest. You've just moved a little farther south.
I'm really the one who went the farthest I humanly could. I think it is somewhat funny that I went to the place that is nuclear free and doesn't allow for anything that my father grew up to. My dad always says, oh, you know, you moved to New Zealand because you were rebelling against us. And it was like, oh, it's just by accident.
We'll get to that here in a second. When you were in high school, were you a good student? And what subjects did you enjoy in high school?
I was a terrible student.
Yay, I love to hear that.
I was not a good student. I was really bored a lot of the time in high school. And I really loved English. And I really enjoyed reading. I really enjoyed writing. I didn't enjoy my science classes all that much. I was not a good student at all. When I was 16, I applied to get into the Running Start program. Running Start's a program in Washington State where the Washington State government, the education group, will pay for you to go to a community college if you pass a test. And I fortunately passed the test because I really didn't enjoy my high school experience for a number of reasons. And when I hit community college, I just loved it. I think I went from like a 2.4 GPA to a 3.6 just overnight, because I felt so much more challenged and I was taking the courses that I really wanted to. And one of my courses was geology, which I really loved. I just really fell in love with that learning environment versus the high school learning environment. I finally felt like this was the way that I had wanted to learn, and high school just didn't feel like a good fit for me.
After community college, where did you head? Because I'm guessing if you were there at 16, you're leaving community college at 18 with an associate's when your peers are just graduating high school.
That's right. So I graduated high school 1 week and then graduated with my AA the next week. And so I was 18 when I had my 2-year degree, and I had this kind of view, like I had to finish so quickly. I had to rush through all of these steps so much. And I don't know what necessarily was compelling me, but there was just something kind of pushing me along. It definitely wasn't sort of pressure from my parents or anything like that. I just felt like I just didn't want to waste time. Like I just didn't want to waste any of my life in high school or in a, you know, spending 4 years at a college. So I went to, I finished at 18 from, what was it? CBC. So Columbia Basin Community College is, I'm a proud graduate, 1996. And then Hanford High School is my alma mater in the Tri-Cities. And then I moved to Ellensburg, Washington, which is Central Washington University. So I moved there when I was 18 to start my degree. And the reason why I chose Central Washington was Washington State University and University of Washington at the time said they wouldn't take your associate's degree solely. You still had to take, you know, another 6 months to a year worth of classes and to get to the junior level that you wanted to be at. So they wouldn't completely take all of my credits. And I didn't want to waste time. I don't know. I just was obsessed about wasting time at that point in time in my life. I wish someone would have told me, slow down, Sarah, just enjoy your life.
Boy, isn't that the case? I've got a 20-year-old who's, just rushing to get it all done as quick as she can. And her brother, who's 4 years behind, 16, about to turn 17, is very much that same way. You can't tell kids what to do.
No, and my parents, I think, were worried, but they, I have amazing parents. They're just so patient, and supportive. And they were kind of like, well, that's just Sarah. She's just super motivated. And you know, we can't hold her back. She's just going to do what she's going to do. So I went to Ellensburg and I did okay. I think I had a 3.1 GPA from Central Washington. I really enjoyed my psych classes and stuff. And so I was 18 to 20. I was at Central and in this small little town in Ellensburg, which is in Central Washington. And then I moved to Spokane to start law school at Gonzaga Law School.
All right. So this is a fun circuitous path. Was law school kind of in your crosshairs coming out of high school?
Oh, yeah. I thought I was going to – my goal was to get to the Supreme Court. I was like, I want to be a Supreme Court justice. Like, not Supreme Court, but like Washington State Supreme Court. Like some state Supreme Court. I really had it in my mind that being a judge was the pathway that I was going to take. And that was the thing that I really wanted to do because I was really attracted to the fairness, what I perceived to be the fairness of the law. Ha ha ha. What I perceived to be a community good that I could do and apply my sensibility towards. So, you know, here I am 20 years old entering into law school, and Spokane is a much bigger city than I've ever lived in. It's, you know, 300,000-400,000 people, and it is, you know, pretty overwhelming in my first year. And I'm sure you can guess what happened. I got a D in my legal writing class, which then put me on academic suspension for a year. And then,
And Gonzaga's, I mean, that's a pretty good law school. I've got a friend of mine that went there, and that's nothing to sneeze at.
No, and I was really proud that I got in. And, you know, that was really the first time I had ever failed, really epically failed. And that really hit me like a ton of bricks. To be suspended for a year. I thought my life was over. I thought I had just washed out and I was an embarrassment to my parents and to my community. And I just wish I could have just tell myself now, like, look, you know, failure's a part of it. Failure's a part of this thing called life. And that's okay. You're going to fail. But I just had this, a lot of shame related to it. And then I started sort of sitting back and thinking about this logically and thinking, okay, if I want to go back to law school, which at that point I did, I need to become a better writer. So what's the journey into being a better writer? Well, I went and took a journalism course at Eastern Washington University from a guy called Steve Blewett. And I got a 3.7 in the class. So I'd gotten an A minus. And I remember like going into his office and bursting into tears and having this big emotional moment, like, and being like, I never thought I would do anything again because I had this epic failure in law school. And he had this huge sigh and he just looked at me and he was like, look, when I was your age, I wanted to be a doctor. And my father was a doctor. His father was a doctor. Everyone was a doctor. And I took chemistry 3 times and I failed each time. And they finally told me it was just never going to happen. And so I had to look for something else. And he goes, I felt exactly the same way you have. And I found journalism and that was the thing for me. And he goes, I don't think you're actually a journalist. He said, I think you'd be really good in public relations and communication. And I have this new certificate program I'd like you to try out because I think you could be really successful at it. And that's kind of how that communication side started, was, you know, really important, meaningful mentorship at the right time in my life.
When you found yourself with the ability to go back to law school, did you give it another shot or did you just say no?
I decided no. I really took that year to reflect. I did some other jobs. I worked at a crisis youth shelter, working with kids. I worked doing communication for a computer-aided design software reseller in Spokane. And I ended up getting a job at a TV station as well on the weekend, being an internet content producer in 2000, which is like sort of like the beginning of online media, which was fantastic learning experience. And I kind of realized that, wow, there's just so much more to life and there's so much more to a career. And I found the law really argumentative and really litigious and really just not necessarily a place that I could see myself in anymore. And so, yeah, I never gave law school another shot. I've thought about it occasionally here and there, but I kind of feel like, it actually worked out really well for me. And I think I have a much more interesting pathway now than I probably would have had if I would have stayed a lawyer.
What's the path you take before you decide that you want to pursue a PhD?
So I knew I'd wanted to do a PhD. The first inkling I had was when I'd gone to Christchurch, lived there for 2 years in New Zealand, and I'd met my future ex-husband there. And my work permit was running out, so I decided to go and get a master's degree in something in disaster-related field.
All right, so I got to back up first. What takes a young 20-something to pick up from Eastern Washington to go to New Zealand in the first place?
Just, I don't know.
Was it a sense of adventure?
Yeah, it was a sense of adventure. Maybe I'd watched too much Xena Warrior Princess. There's
no such thing, number one. Let's just be perfectly clear. There's no such thing as too much Lucy Lawless. I want to go back, and something just popped into my mind. You had mentioned that you grew up LDS, Mormon.
Right, right.
Did you do the Mormon mission?
No, I didn't. Again, my life's full of fantastic, like false starts. I got to age 21 and I was thinking about my mission, because back then you had to be 21 years old as a woman to go on a mission. And I really just kind of, for a lot of reasons, just felt like the church was just not the right place for me. And I want to be clear here, because there's kind of this mythos around people who aren't active in the church that somehow we're angry or mad or vengeful. I have a lot of affection for the church in my upbringing. I consider myself a lazy Mormon more than anything else. It's not my jam, but I have a lot of affection for it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I did not go on a mission. I did not pursue going the full Mormon, if that's what you're asking. I didn't go to the temple and get, you know, do that. But yeah, it's just...
Fair enough. And we don't need to talk about it anymore. But that sense of adventure then... takes you to New Zealand. What do you too much Xena Warrior Princess, but again, no such thing. Was there something specific about New Zealand though, it was Lord of the Rings, wasn't it?
Actually, I was there before Lord of the Rings, so I'm officially a New Zealand hipster. I was there before Lord of the Rings came out. I went there the year it came out. But it didn't come out for a few months before I'd gotten there. With New Zealand, it was really weird. It was, you know, when I was 16, I would be talking to my mom about places I'd want to go. And I said, I just really want to go to New Zealand. And she's like, why? And I'm like, I don't know. And to this day, I cannot tell you why. I mean, I can make jokes about it, but I can't be clear about it. It was just a feeling that I had to go to New Zealand. And that's the only way I can possibly describe it. And yeah.
That's okay. I want to go to Antarctica. Nobody else wants to go.
I want to go. I'm all in for Antarctica, but I'm always...
Penguins are awesome. And I'm always so is in cold for weather.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm always in for, you know, crazy adventures, clearly. Yeah, just there's some places I think that just call to your sensibility, whoever you are. And at 23, I had the resources and the freedom and the ability to make that happen.
No kids, not married.
No kids, not
off
married.
Off to New Zealand.
Off to New Zealand, feeling like
you're just full of piss and vigor. That's
just
all
like,
you
know,
need right there.
Well, I also had this kind of confidence of, you know, with law school, I'm like, well, I've failed before and I've recovered. That's the great thing about failure, is that when you have failed,
yes,
you feel like, oh, I know what this feels like now. I know how hard this is. But now that I've done it once, if I do it again, well, I know how to get myself out of this situation. It's the arrogance of youth, really, that sort of, it's like, I can fail and, you know, who knows? And yeah, I think looking back, it was a pretty, at 23, you know, traveling, I don't know, 10,000 miles away from my family and friends, from anyone I could possibly know, to go to New Zealand was a pretty ballsy thing to do.
Did you have a job lined up before you got there?
I had what was called a homestay. And what I did was, it's like woofing, which is sort of organic farming. So you go on farms and you work on the organic farm to stay there and for room and board, essentially. So it's kind of not a commune, but, you know, so I had this situation with a really lovely bachelor farmer. His name's John McCaskey, and he lives up in Waipara in New Zealand. And he hosted me for 9 months while I worked on his, well, I did this woofing thing back in 2001.
But you met a boy.
I did. I met a boy in Amberley. He was from a place called Rangiora.
And you decided to stay. You went back to school so you could stay.
Well, I decided to say I got a job in New Zealand and I could stay there. I got a job at the New Zealand Blood Service doing donor recruitment, which is sort of like PR for blood donations for the National Blood Service. And I was there for 18 months. And I had a work permit during that time. New Zealand had gone through a mini recession and I was told by immigration I wouldn't get my work permit extended, or it was unlikely I'd get my work permit extended and that I'd have to make other plans. And so I kind of did this like, well, what am I interested in? And I had worked on a project around planning for major disasters for the blood service, because I was really interested in crisis communication at that time. And I was like, oh, you know, does anyone really do this professionally? Is this a job? Is this something I can do? Can I work in disasters professionally? Can I be a communicator in this space? And I thought, well, I need more education. I need more training and I need to leave. So I want to get my master's. And I looked around on the internet for like, where are the schools that have this? And this was pre-Katrina. So there was not that many schools. And at the time there were really four schools that I was sort of looking at. One was Columbia, which required, I think, three languages and some letters from the United Nations, like someone from the United Nations, like impossible to get into the Columbia school. University of Delaware, University of Colorado, Boulder, and
my alma mater, by the way,
which is a fantastic school and they're awesome. And I'm not saying that because you're an alma mater, but I have a lot of time for them. And University of Hawaii at Manoa, which had this master's degree in public administration, but this new kind of program on disaster management, humanitarian assistance. And so the problem with Colorado and Delaware is that they all required GREs scores. And I had kind of missed, I had missed the deadline for the GRE. And it was really difficult at that time to take the GRE in New Zealand and get those results over to the United States in time. So I just was going to miss it. Whereas the University of Hawaii group did not require at that time a GRE score. They required an interview because they picked people based on a cohort. they wanted a chemistry between a group of people who had very differing experiences. And I think they must have looked at me and thought, wow, you're really weird. And we're, you know, we think we're into weird people. So would you want to come? And I remember thinking, I'm going to apply for this scholarship as a part of the school. And if I get this scholarship, I'll go to University of Hawaii. And I got the scholarship and I ended up going.
How long were you in Hawaii?
In Hawaii? I was in Hawaii for almost 3 years. At that time, me and my, you know, future ex-husband, he would come over to Hawaii, to Hawaii for 3 months at a time. And then he would come back to New Zealand for 3 months so that we didn't get into any trouble with immigration. And because we weren't ready to get married. And then we ended up getting married in Hawaii.
So 3 years in Hawaii, was that all spent on the master's? Or did you have a job post?
I had a job in Hawaii. I was working for the University of Hawaii Library. But when I moved back to Christchurch, I didn't have a job. I knew that there was a job coming that was a part-time job working for the Canterbury Civil Defense Emergency Management Group that was in public education and public information, the kind of role I wanted. Now, it was only part-time, so I thought, okay, well, there might be a potential to do a PhD with University of Canterbury.
So at that point, did you know coming out of your master's that you wanted to go the distance, so to speak?
Yeah, I absolutely knew I wanted to go the distance at that point. I had another mentor, John Egan at University of Hawaii, who taught the disaster management class. And he and I talked about it quite a bit. And Skip Burkle was also one of my teachers. And we talked about the PhD, and they had really encouraged me to continue on and do a PhD. But I knew that I wanted to save my relationship with my Kiwi guy and that I was going to have to move back to New Zealand. So I couldn't stay at University of Hawaii and finish my PhD. And so instead we moved back to Christchurch. And I kind of knew, and I started progressing down the road with University of Canterbury, and my ex-husband turned around and said, I think you have enough education. In fact, you might have too much, and I'm not going to support you during your PhD.
Speaking as a father of a young lady, that's a red flag.
Yeah, but I was already married. So, you know, what could I do? And I couldn't sign up. So what ended up happening was this lovely professor who put a lot of faith in me to write a good proposal. I ended up bombing the proposal and she was very disappointed. And I couldn't tell her the truth, which was I'm in a marriage that is not great and he won't support me and I have to kind of align to his wishes. And so, you know, I felt bad because we still run in the same, I still run the same circles as she does. And I've had to chat with her about it a couple of times, just apologize for wasting her time. But, yeah, I mean, that was really hard to hear that you have too much education and that I wasn't going to get supported. And eventually the council that I worked for, the Canterbury, the Environment Canterbury gave me a full-time position. So I ended up working for them full-time. But I would have been down this road a lot further. I would have done a different dissertation. It would have been a very different dissertation. I think it still would have been a great dissertation given who I wanted to work with. But it just, you know, it just kind of wasn't right time, right place at that moment.
So how do you eventually get into your PhD program?
Ooh, okay, so we're getting there. I know this is a lot of exposition.
Yeah, no. That's what I do. That's what Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is. It's, you know, these journeys aren't generally quick. They take a while, and I like to build it up, and I want to know what it is that led you down this path.
So in 2009, in September 2009, Samoa was hit by a tsunami. It was a magnitude 8.2. And I had known some people who went out to go do emergency response or humanitarian response there. And they asked me if I wanted to join, and I did. And at this point, my marriage was on its last legs. And I went out to Samoa and it's 10 years still, and it's still a very that was a very difficult response to go to. It was a really hard response. I remember, you know, I was doing interviews and trying to, you know, raise awareness through the NGO about the humanitarian crisis that was going on in Samoa. And I remember going up to one of the sites. So the people who had experienced this tsunami, they had gone up into the hills and they weren't coming back down. So we had to go to them. And I remember there was this like tarpaulin and there was this woman sitting in the middle of underneath this tarpaulin on sort of a cement platform. And there was food around her and there was these pots of rice and, you know, things, but she wasn't really eating. And, you know, people were occasionally putting things in front of her for her to eat and she wasn't touching anything. And she was just kind of staring into space. And I kind of asked my translator what was going on and she kind of inquired and then she came back and she said, well, that woman had 4 kids and now she has 2.
Wow.
And she had to choose which ones to carry. You know, and what, sorry.
No, it's, don't apologize.
What do you give when you have nothing to give? Like there was nothing I could do for this woman at all. Like, how can you try to comfort someone in a situation that is so unimaginable? And I remember getting back to Christchurch after that experience and having seen this and having witness this really difficult event, and you know, trying to comfort these people in the best I could, and I remember having another fight with my ex-husband and just thinking, God, life is too short for this. It's too short to be miserable with someone, and I'm making him miserable and he's making me miserable, and it's just, life is too short. And he said something to me and I packed my bags and that was it. That was kind of the end of that marriage. And, yeah. So, whew, sorry about that.
No, it's fine. So how do you begin the next chapter? That's your jumping off point. You've identified, you've at least come, I think in the back of your brain, what I'm kind of getting to here or assuming is that now in the back of your brain, you've kind of have an idea of what you want to do for a PhD. What is that kind of the starting point of
it? Yeah. I mean, that was the starting point of going, I'm not going to stop myself because of a relationship. Like, I'm not going to stop doing the things that I love because the person I love is going to stop me. Like, that's not the person I can't be with someone who is going to stop me from doing the things that I feel I need to do. And I stayed in Christchurch for about 10 months after that, figuring out what I was going to do next. And then there was this job opening in the Solomon Islands. And I, as a volunteer, so I worked with World Vision and I was there for a year. And on my way to the Solomon Islands, I was traveling around the world to get there. And I was in Iceland on the 4th of September, 2010, with my girlfriends who I worked with at Environment Canterbury. One was the geologist of the region, Helen Grant, and then Jessica Peterson, who was at that time, she had just resigned from the Ministry of Civil Defense and Emergency Management, their recovery manager. And so we were there in Iceland because we wanted to hang out with volcanoes and, you know, we're part of this sisterhood that loves, you know, volcanoes. And something came across my Twitter feed about a big earthquake in Christchurch. And here are these 3 women in the middle of Iceland chasing volcanoes. And our home region in Canterbury, in Christchurch, has just been impacted by the largest earthquake that we've had close to people in decades. And, yeah, we were all pretty devastated about that. And Helen got on a plane when she got back to England. She got right on a plane and went back to Christchurch. But I had quit my job. I had, you know, it was my job. I was working for the Canterbury CDM Group as their public education, public information person. And then I started seeing this kind of interesting discourse come through Twitter and the media, which was like, oh, well, no one told us that it could happen here. You know, no one told us that we could have earthquakes in Christchurch. And I was sitting there thinking, oh, but we, you know, we created these booklets and brochures and we go out to AMP shows, which are like, you know, country fairs. And, you know, we told you, like, we had this in documents. Like, why are you saying we didn't tell you? And so it kind of stuck in my craw a little bit for a while. And then I eventually, you know, got to the Solomon Islands and started my work there. And I'd sent some emails back to my previous work colleagues and said, do you want me to come back to Canterbury? Do you want me to come back to Christchurch to work during the Darfield earthquake, which is what the earthquake was on the 4th of September. It was called the Darfield earthquake. And, they were like, no, it's fine. You know, it's not too much damage. It's scary. Yes. But you know, I think we're holding it together and everything's fine. So we're all good. And I was like, okay. So yeah, got to Solomon's, sort of settled into this Solomon Islands, which again, I don't know. The Solomon Islands is another unique chapter in my life that I'm really grateful for. The Solomon Islands is a very beautiful country. It's full of amazing people. A lot of poverty and a lot of injustice is there. It was an amazing gift to go.
Did you feel the lawyer start to come out in you?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly was like, this isn't right. You can't treat women this way, or this isn't right. You know, you can't treat a group of people this way. So I felt, you know, that sense of justice, you know, was very much like, oh, how can this possibly be okay? And I really tried my best. And I don't think I always achieved this, but I really tried my best to be as non-judgmental as I could and to be as patient as I could and to really recognize the depth of, you know, I was coming from a very different place than the people I was working with were coming from. And I had been exposed to a very different framework ethically and morally than they had been raised in. And I had to have patience with that. And it wasn't always about me and what I thought. It was just sometimes in the Solomons, I often felt like the best thing I could do was listen and witness and tell stories. And that was kind of all I could do there. So, very interesting experience.
So you returned to New Zealand then from the Solomons?
So on the 22nd of February, 2011, I think it was at 12:51 PM, a 6.3 magnitude earthquake struck right under the city of Christchurch, about 5 kilometers down, which is very shallow. And the shaking was very intense. And this was part of the aftershock sequence of Darfield. So Darfield happened in September 2010, and Christchurch happened on the 22nd of February 2011, 6 months later. And when that happened, I received a text message from my in-country advisor. And he said, there's been a massive earthquake in Christchurch. Fatalities are expected. And do you want to go home? And I just didn't know what to think. And I went online as soon as I could. And some of the first fatalities were coming up. And I had known, I mean, we weren't close friends, but I had known some of the people who'd worked at the Canterbury television station, CTV building. And one of the first people that popped up was a reporter that I'd worked with very, you know, pretty frequently in civil defense. And I was just like, wow, this is, I know these people and they're gone. And, you know, what's going on? This is my, you know, I'd always envisioned I'd move back to Christchurch, you know, maybe. I mean, I think, you know, there was kind of an unspoken agreement between me and my ex-husband that he got Christchurch in the divorce. But I was like, wow, you know, when you're away in the Solomon Islands and it's not a very developed area, you know, I'd sort of fantasized about going to my favorite places and hanging out in Cathedral Square and hanging out at my favorite piano bar and, you know, going and being with my friends and realizing that that was going to be all gone that there was no more of that, that part, that the city that I loved was now gone, that I'd grown to love was now gone. Anyway, so I think I emailed my old boss and said, do you want me to come back? Here's my number in the Solomons. I got a phone call that night from Lee Cowan, who is, was the public information manager, for the earthquake. And she said, here's what we want to give you. We want to give you the community relations role. It's a role no one's done. Do you want to come back? And I said, yes, I would. And so it took me about 3 or 4 days to get out of the Solomons. It's not an easy place to jump on a plane and get out of. And so it took me about, I think I was there 5 or 7 days after the initial damaging earthquake. And, I got there, I crashed at a friend's house. And then the next morning I woke up and I was in the emergency operations center in the art gallery in Christchurch. And I was the community relations manager for a couple of weeks in the national response. And then, after a few weeks, I got bumped up to public information manager, second in command. So I had me and Lee, who she's this lovely English rose, soft, warm personality. And I'm sort of a crass, loudmouth American. And I have never been so challenged and exhausted, but enjoyed working so much with a group of people. I mean, they were phenomenal underneath really tough situations. You know, I was working with people who had lost their homes or lost friends or family members in the quake, and they showed up to work every day, and they were phenomenal. And I you know, there were moments where I'd come out of the EOC, the Emergency Operations Center, and you have to imagine, you know, like, we have like 1200 media outlets outside our front door. There's, you know, the BBC and CNN and Japanese media, and media from all over the world are coming to be there. And so we're trying to organize all of this. And it's like, I remember one day I came out with my cup of coffee and I looked out and there was the cathedral, and the front had fallen off the cathedral, and, you know, it was damaged from where I could see it. And I just, that was finally the moment where, you know, it really all hit me that how much was gone. And in that night, I remember, I mean, this was not I can't remember when it was in the, you know, it's all very foggy. My colleagues and I joke that if you remember what happened in Christchurch, you weren't really in Christchurch. But cause it just all went by so crazy. But I remember driving home one night and seeing no lights in the CBD in the Central Business District, and just feeling like the city had died and that the heartbeat was gone, and just feeling that the loss of that city. And, so yeah, I felt, On one hand, grieving for this whole thing, grieving for the city and grieving for the people who had lost loved ones, and enraptured and tied in that was obviously the loss of the marriage and the grief around that. And so I was a hot mess in the Christchurch response. And if any of my Christchurch response people are listening, I'm really sorry if I was terrible to you. But it was a very fraught time for everyone. And anyway, so on the, I was offered a chance to stay and continue working with another agency on a 3-month contract. So I wanted to extend my time. Away from the Solomon Islands to Christchurch. And the agency came back and said, no, you either are on the plane to come back on the 12th of April, or you don't come back. You resign your position in the Solomons. And I had to make the decision whether I was going to stay in Christchurch and help with the rebuild, or if I was going to return to the Solomon Islands. And I really hummed and hawed. And I have two mentors, Bill and Wilma, and I called both of them, and they both gave me the same answer, which was, no, you need to go back to the Solomons. This is something you've committed to do. And Christchurch, this recovery is going to take a really long time, and you need to, this is the long game. You need to recover from this. You're exhausted, and it's just too close and too raw. And they really were looking out for me. They were like, you know, you need to take a break from this. You need to go and finish what you started in the Solomons. So I got on the plane on the 12th of April, crying the whole way back to the Solomon Islands because I was heartbroken about not staying, but I kind of knew it was the best thing to go back.
What's that decision to get your PhD? What really informs that?
So, you know, like I said, the grain had been started about why people didn't understand the information we were giving them in Christchurch. So that kind of was the nugget that it was sort of building up. And I had gotten I knew a professor, or Professor David Johnston, who worked at GNS Science at the time. And I was like, David, I emailed him and I'm like, I'm thinking about coming back. And he's like, hey, I've got a maternity leave position for Julia Becker. Would you want to come and do this for a year? Cause I said, I really want to help out with Christchurch. And I applied, I got it and I left the Solomons. And I remember sitting at Julia's desk. It was a social science position. And I remember thinking, I have no idea what I'm doing. I have been a communicator for 14 years at that point, and I had never done any social science research. I didn't know at all how to do it. And I remember I sort of walked around GNS for 6 weeks in this haze going, I have no idea what I'm doing, but I don't want to tell anyone. And then I sat down with David one day and I said, David, I don't know what I'm doing. And he goes, yeah, I know. And I said, I think I need to go back and do my PhD and really learn how to do this properly. And he goes, excellent. I have some funding paperwork here that I've put together for you. I was just waiting for you to ask. So David Johnston is one of the craftiest people I know. And he completely knew, but he waited for me to say, I think I really don't know what I'm doing. And I want to go back and learn how to do this and learn this properly. And he was like, yep, here's your funding for 3 years. Here's your scholarship. Here's what I think you should do it on because of what we've been talking about. And yeah, here you go. And so I put my proposal in, got some PhD supervisors, and I was away.
I love the title.
The Canterbury Tales.
The Canterbury Tales, an insider's lessons and reflections from the Canterbury earthquake sequence to inform better public communication models.
I had done it as a part of my job to do a biannual survey in Canterbury. And this had started in 2000. And so we worked with Opinions Market Research, which is a market agency, and they went out and did this work. So it wasn't mine. The piece that I did was I analyzed using best practice literature, using what we know in social science. And I used 34 different disciplines to develop this sort of analysis matrix. And I analyzed the booklets we had created in Canterbury to see, you know, if we had used any of these best practices and why on our end it might have failed. Because the question about the interviewing before and after had already been done by Opinions Market Research and by John McClure, which is cited in my dissertation. And so that work had kind of already been done. What I wanted to do was a piece really on reflection. What's the internal working? So what happens internally amongst the group of people, amongst the communication people and emergency managers and scientists? When they're developing a brochure, what's that process about? And what is the byproduct? What's the artifacts that come from these relationships between these people? And then I wanted to analyze it based on what we understood on what we should have been doing versus what we actually did. And it was a really interesting transfer because, you know, I sort of started my dissertation thinking, you know, why are people so stupid? Why don't they just listen to us? We had all these booklets and, you know, we had all these, that's all these pieces of information. Like why aren't they reading this?
They had the water. Why didn't
exactly.
they drink
it? Like I dragged them to the water. You know, we worked on these really beautiful booklets and I have to say, they weren't, this was a group work. It wasn't like I wrote them all by myself or did the work by myself. Like this was a group effort amongst many people to write these booklets and brochures. And when I analyzed them, I came up with some pretty startling things that I found. Like I used readability tests and I found that, you know, some of these booklets were written for 23-year-old readability. And were written very technically and with a lot of jargon and a lot of gobbledygook and a lot of very dense material that made it really difficult for anyone who didn't have a bachelor's degree in engineering or in science to understand. Pardon me. And so really when I got down to like the demographic, because I was like, okay, well, you know, 22% of Canterbury has more than a bachelor's degree, and, you know, 5% of the people who have bachelor's degrees or whatever it was, like 9-10% have science or engineering degrees. And then I kept on going down and down to like the smaller demographic. And it finally, the shoe dropped with me. I'm like, oh my God, we wrote booklets for ourselves. We wrote booklets to talk to ourselves, to people who think about the world like we do and talk about the world like we do. We didn't write these for other people. We actually ended up, albeit incredibly well-meaning and very, you know, very thoughtful about the writing process, we ended up just, yeah, writing stuff for people who thought like us. And that was a tough day at the lab when I made that realization. And I was like, wow, that's why we're failing, is because we're just talking to ourselves.
A similar thing happened with a previous guest of mine. She works in public health, specifically sex ed, and found a similar thing in terms of trying to communicate not just across socioeconomic lines, education levels, but also across multiple cultures, and having to make sure that you're aware of how to communicate issues for sexual health. Those are items that are that can sometimes be tableau in certain segments, whether it's a Hispanic population, which tends to be Catholic, et cetera. I'm getting off base here, but it is, I get the sense that what you learned is that you need to understand who your population is in order to write effective information.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's sort of communication 101. And, you know, as a trained communicator, I should have known that, you know, I should have picked up on that. And it really was this moment of like, wow, the failure really does sit a lot with me in terms of those booklets. The people who helped write them were phenomenally good communicators, and they were great scientists and emergency managers, but I felt like I had failed them in going, hey, wait a minute, what about the audience? Do we have the right demographic? Are we pitching this at the right level? And that, you know, that again, you know, that failure was like, wow, I've been kind of running around resenting the people of Canterbury for not reading my booklets and realizing actually that I was a part of that problem. And that was, like I said, that was a tough day, tough couple of days at the lab.
How long did you finished your PhD in 3 years?
3 years, 20 days and 3 years, 10 months and 20 days.
Not counting. What did you do after? I got it. All right. So all this time that you're spending in New Zealand, do your family members come over to visit you at all, or did they wait until you got the PhD?
They came over to visit me. They didn't come over too often. You know, my parents are a little bit older, and it's a really long flight. And I want to say, you know, the PhD was a very uneven process for me. I was really lucky. I had four phenomenally supportive supervisors. Not everyone has that experience. Some people have very negative relationships with their supervisors. I was very lucky. I had kind of the dream team. I used to call them my supers because they were like these super people who kept me going. And my first year, I had the same exact problem I had at GNS Science earlier, which was I was walking around and I thought, like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I didn't want to tell anyone that I didn't know what I was doing. Cause I felt like, oh, I have all this experience and, you know, look at me. I'm like this, you know, I was a PIO in Christchurch, and you know, I just had this huge ego running around, not wanting to tell people that I'm not actually great in this space. And then after that first year, me and my primary supervisor had a really hard talk, which was, she's like, look, you're not achieving what you should be. You're not where you should be right now. And I don't know how to dig you out of this hole. And if you don't kind of pull it out and pull yourself together and stop making excuses and stop kind of talking around it and making plans, if you don't just sit down and do the reading and do the work, you're going to fail out. And I knew I didn't want to fail out. And I knew I had to admit I didn't know what I was doing. So I told her I didn't know what I was doing. And we kind of developed this plan. And I ended up taking 200 articles with me out to this bed and breakfast for a week. And I woke up every day and I read 16 articles a day. And I wrote reports on each of the articles. And I just churned through these 200. And I didn't leave until these 200 articles were done. And I remember my reward every day was like an hour of Game of Thrones. Like I couldn't have internet access. I think I had internet access for 10 minutes a day. And I just did this massive read through of all the literature. And then when I came back from my writing and reading retreat, I kept doing 10 papers a day because I'd finally gotten to that pace of just doing the literature review. And that's eventually that work of creating this big table with all of this information from these articles eventually became the basis of my method of developing a coding matrix or a coding schema for the content analysis. So, I think it's probably, if I could say one big lesson for myself, it's like, just don't pretend like you know what you're doing. Just admit that you don't, and then be honest about that, and then find a way that works. Once I did that, and then I started actually producing work that was rigorous and that was thoughtful, I got a writing tutor. So I got help. There was free writing tutors at Massey University, which was great. I started talking to librarians. I started really asking for help beyond my supervisory team. Not because I didn't want to have their help, but because I knew that I needed so much to catch up to where I needed to be. And so really my first year was almost a complete fail. And the bulk of the work was really done in 2.5 years. And that's not on anyone else's. That's on me. That's not.
Yeah. You get this thing finished in 2017. That's a big weight off your shoulders. What'd you do next?
So during the time of the dissertation, I'd also been taking part-time contracts at GeoNet, GNS Science again. So GeoNet's like the monitoring, GeoNet is the monitoring project or agency, if you will, for New Zealand regarding earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamis, and landslides. And I was doing, I took one maternity leave contract to do their social media and another one for communication because I was really afraid for some reason. So I took a whole year off of not working. That was the second year where I was going to fail out. Took a full year off. And then I was able to take contracts because I was really worried for some reason that I was going to lose touch with my practitioner skills, with my communication practitioner skills. If I continued just being in academia, I was really afraid of that for some reason. And so I convinced my supervisors to let me take part-time jobs and go part-time in my dissertation. And then kind of in May 2016, I knew that I wasn't going to get a postdoc at GNS or at Massey University. There's not a lot of postdocs in New Zealand and there wasn't really anything opening up. And so I just started applying to different places and I applied to the USGS for their Mendenhall postdoc. And I didn't think I had any chance to get this postdoc because, you know, when you're looking at the USGS and the quality of the scholars that are there, you know, they went to MIT and Caltech and Harvard and Yale and Stanford and, you know, these really big name schools with fantastic academic records. And here I am from like Massey University in Wellington thinking, okay, well, I'll try. And I put a proposal in. They interviewed me and I got an offer to get the Mendenhall Fellowship. So I submitted my dissertation on, it was like early November. And exactly a month later, the Kaikoura earthquake happened, which was a magnitude 7.8 in New Zealand. And I was there in Wellington. I felt it. It was a minute and a half long, maybe a little bit longer in terms of shaking, very intense shaking. And I was the on-call public information manager for GeoNet at the time. And my two colleagues were down south in Dunedin. And so I've done a lot of dumb things, but a really dumb thing was not taking a break after my submission of my dissertation. I held that off and just kept working at GeoNet. And Kaikoura happened and everything changed overnight. And I worked pretty tirelessly. I don't think I left the lower hut area at GNS for about a week. My husband didn't see me for a week, my new husband, because, you know, I met someone else. And that was a very intense period of time. And then I was still doing response for Kaikoura when I had to do my defense for my PhD. So
that's burning the candle at both ends, lady.
Yeah. So, so in New Zealand, the examination is really different than here in the United States. So, it's not your advisory panel that does any examination. Your supervisors actually can have nothing to do with your examination. It was one internal, Massey University examiner, one New Zealand based examiner, and one international examiner. And I couldn't know who they were. And they could not have worked with me at any time. So they couldn't have any personal connection to me through authorship. And I was never given their reports to know whether I would pass or not. I was only told, like, so my primary supervisor, Elspeth, did not give me any information about, she got the reports the day before, but she couldn't tell me what they said. She could only provide some like allusions to what they might ask to help me formulate my argumentation for my defense. So I'm flying in completely blind here for my defense. Like, I don't know these people. They don't know me. I don't know what they've said in their reports. I don't know if they love it. I don't know if they hate it. I don't know if I'm going to pass. I don't know anything. And I walk into the room and I defend my thesis, and I walked out with just minor emendations. It took me about a week to get all of those fixes done while I was working, still finishing up the response for Kaikoura. And then I went through what I like to call my triathlon of life games. So at the end of March, I confirmed to the USGS that I had my dissertation. I could take the postdoctoral fellowship. And they were like, great, can you come at the end of June? And I was like, yes, I can come at the end of June. And then I had to, you know, quit my job at GeoNet, which was really hard because I really loved working at GeoNet. They're fantastic staff, and I really loved my job. I was the information manager there. I got my New Zealand citizenship. My husband asked me to marry him. I graduated with my dissertation, and we got married within a 6-week period of time.
You don't wait around, lady.
I know. So I was like, okay, let's just ram all these through. Maybe the citizenship was in earlier April, but it was just like a real, like, 2 or 3 months of just intense work because, you know, obviously if I was going to go to the US, I'd been in a solid partnership for 3 years with Martin, and, you know, we just really got each other. And I think that the amazing thing about between the first and the second marriage, when I told Martin about the postdoc and, you know, it's going to be a challenge and we'd have to move to the States and we'd have to leave Wellington, which we both loved. He just looked at me and he's like, you got to do it. He goes, you got to do it. You got to push, you know, like, I'm so supportive of you pushing yourself further and learning more and growing more as a person. And it was such a new thing to hear someone say that to me. And I was like, I can't give up on this relationship. So, you know, we decided to do that whole immigration thing. And it took us 16 months to get him over here. So he came last September after I moved here. So it took a long time to get him here, but, we eventually did it.
And you're in the San Francisco Bay Area,
I'm in Mountain View. Yeah.
This postdoc that you have with USGS, how long does that last? And then what do you see yourself doing next?
So the postdoc is a 2-year postdoc, and I've already gotten an extra year of funding. So I've got 3 years, and that funding ends, I think, around October 2020. So I've got probably another 18 months to go. And I kind of don't know what's next. I mean, I'd really love to stay at the USGS. But, you know, we don't always get what we want. It's an uncertain environment at the moment. I'll be looking for opportunities over the next 18 months. I'm really excited to, you know, be publishing with the USGS and having access and working with all these amazing scholars is great. I don't know what the future is. All I know is it's probably going to be something weird.
I love that. As we're wrapping up here, do you see yourself going down the academic route, or do you want to stay more engaged with what's happening around the world?
It's really hard.
And not that those are separate items.
Yeah. You know, I've really thought about this a lot. You know, do I want to pursue the really intriguing and rich area of academia, or do I want to, you know, go into like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or work at the United Nations? I mean, both of those appeal to me differently. I don't know. I know I should be stressed out probably about the fact that I don't have anything permanent. There's something about academia and about the PhD that for some reason, every PhD I've ever known who didn't have a permanent position or a fixed term position always felt really stressed that they didn't have a fixed term position. Whereas, you know, because I'd had 15 years of having jobs that could end that day and knowing I could get a job in 2 weeks' time, I never felt that kind of stress, the same amount of stress, I think. It's only been since I've hit academia that I'm like, oh, what am I going to do 2 years from now? And the old me would just probably have laughed and been like, 2 years from now, you don't know what you're going to do 2 months from now. Why are you stressed out about this? But the older I get, the more I'm like, oh, I really should find something more permanent and more stable and those kinds of things. So I don't know what the future holds. I know a couple of people who are really good at writing 5-year plans, and they're really great at goals, and they achieve those goals, and I am in awe of them, because every goal I've ever had, like law school, failed miserably. And it's only by the things that I've kind of wanted, but I haven't like sat down and written out a 5-year plan.
It's more fun to live by the seat of your pants.
Yeah. I don't know if researchers can do that, but I seem to be okay a little bit with that, and kind of a see where it goes situation. Like I said, it's such a great honor to be a public servant, and to be a public servant scientist. It's a phenomenal feeling. So I do hope it works out. But you know, if it doesn't, I think I'll find something interesting no matter what. Like I said, whatever it'll be weird.
So the takeaway for your dissertation, is it really about helping governmental agencies, NGOs, people that are trying to help the general public pay attention? Is it about learning how to better communicate with that general public?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a large part of it. There's a piece at the end of my dissertation that talks about it's really about reflective communication strategies. So when you're sitting down as a public practitioner, it's a series of questions to ask yourself that I crafted at the very end. So, you know, hey, really consider these questions before you go too far down. You get too far into the weeds of your own communication and too enamored by what you've created. You know, really be a thoughtful, reflective practitioner, that you are meeting the needs of your audience. So some of the questions that I developed were, you know, I mean, pretty straightforward questions, but they came from this body of knowledge, which is, you know, an example, do I know what I think I know about how my publics communicate and what they want? And then, you know, who have I not talked to that I don't know much about, but has a role in this communication? So who's not, who, where are the silences in here? Who should be in here and isn't in here? In the context of my dissertation, Mari, specifically Naitahu, who is the Iwi on the South Island. That's the tribe on the South Island. They had lived on the South Island for over 1,000 years, and they had rich oral history around earthquakes in this area. And yet their voices had, there was a silence there in these public communication documents. Their voices were not there. They had this oral history, and we did not give them the space to communicate that. So that's what that question is. It's where it comes from, is this acknowledgement of the silence of all of this phenomenal oral history and richness that Naitahu could have given us, which wasn't there. So that was where that question came from. And then the next question was, have I explored relationships with indigenous groups who may have a lot of experience living in this area? Again, following on, with the Naitahu question, am I listening to the publics, or am I more interested in what I have to say?
Isn't that a question we all should be asking ourselves more and more?
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel really bad about this podcast, because I've just rambled on to you about my life, and I've asked very little from you.
No, that's what this is. This is hearing about the journey, because every journey is unique, and yours is certainly up there in its uniqueness, not just because it was done outside of the United States. I've only talked to a couple other PhDs. One other PhD, actually, that did hers, that was in Scotland. But I think what's fascinating, one of the things that's fascinating here is the sheer opportunity that you have moving forward to really help communities, governmental organizations, better communicate to those communities. And I think what you've developed here, and this is just, you know, layman dumb guy in Denver, Colorado, but I think you really have built a model or have the basis for helping communities better be communicated to in the face of growing catastrophes. We're in a world that's full of change. And with the changes of communication that's going on, how best can people be prepared to respond to those things that are happening around them?
Yeah, I think you summed up beautifully my story in a couple of sentences. You know, my findings in a couple of sentences. I do have to say, the PhD journey was really hard, but it was the best thing I have ever done, in terms of my personal, in terms of enriching my personal experience and the way that I look at the world now. And I think I'm a lot more of a thoughtful person. I think I'm a lot more empathetic than I was, you know, 4 years prior. I was obviously quite a hardened, angry person for a lot of reasons. And the dissertation process really, really softened that. And, yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask me, you know, should I do a PhD or not? And I just have to say, you know, is it in you? And if it is, then you kind of have to do it. Even if it's hard, even if it feels impossible, you know, you can overcome so much. You can definitely do a dissertation. A dissertation is not about intelligence. It's really about stamina and focus and keeping on your path as much as you can.
I got to tell you, it's one of the longest dissertations I've ever seen. 310 pages. And that's without the references and appendices and footnotes, et cetera, that are at the end of it. So
thank you.
Great job. Sarah McBride, Dr. Sarah McBride, thank you very much. If you find yourself in Denver again, please give me a call. I will buy the
this
first round.
This has been so great. It's, you know, it's not often that you get to talk to someone and reflect on your life and reflect on everything that led you to this. And I just really want to thank you for being so patient and being willing to let me talk to you about these odd, circular, weird pathways that this experience has taken me down.
I think we all have them. And the more that we hear about the circular pathways that each of us have, the better we are at appreciating the ones that we are experiencing
Fantastic.
Ourselves.
Well, hey, thanks so much, Ted. And I will be in the Denver area and I will definitely take you up on that drink.
Well, and I look forward to meeting Dr. Sarah McBride in person here in the Denver area and sharing a table and some beverages. If you're interested, you can catch Dr. Sarah McBride on the Twitter. She's at disastrouscomms. And I like her her Twitter handle. It also includes a nice bright red stiletto pump shoe. I don't know. What's a guy in yellow Crocs know about footwear, especially women's footwear? Anyway, thanks for listening. You've spent the last 90 plus minutes listening to Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Shoot me an email if you know of a Piled High and Deep yourself that would like to be interviewed for the show. And also, I appreciate any feedback or comments that are left on the podcast listening app of your choice. I'm also on the Twitter. You can check me out at The Mountain Geek. Have a great day. We'll talk to you soon. And until then, keep shoveling.